Israel's Netanyahu is in Washington.
And I will tell my friends on both sides of the aisle that regardless who the American people choose as their next president, Israel remains America's indispensable and strong ally in the Middle East.
Plus, China brokers a deal for Palestinian unity.
The core achievement is to make it clear that the Palestinian Liberation Organization is the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people.
And later, an update from Kyiv, a look at sea drones' usefulness, and another journalist is sentenced to prison in Russia. Today is Tuesday, July 23rd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The big story of the day is Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington, and the Chinese appear to have brokered a deal between rival Palestinian factions. We'll hear more in a few minutes. Starting us off, though, is an update to the story of the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump. The U.S. Secret Service is the government agency tasked with protecting presidents and candidates. The director, Kimberly Cheadle, has resigned after facing calls to do so from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle on Monday. During a contentious congressional hearing, she testified about the agency's failure to prevent the shooting of the former president and current Republican presidential candidate, Donald Trump. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more about concerns regarding security during this year's election season.
9 days after the assassination attempt that shook the nation, there are few answers on how the shooter got so close to Trump. The head of the United States Secret Service, Kimberly Cheadle, answering lawmakers' questions about the shooting for the first time, was blunt.
We failed.
Cheadle said a full report on the agency's failure to protect the former president would be released within 90 days. Lawmakers said that was unacceptable during an election season that has already proved to be contentious. Some called on her to resign. Republican Representative James Comer.
The Secret Service has a zero-fail mission, but it failed on July 13th and in the days leading up to the rally. The Secret Service has thousands of employees and a significant budget, but it has now become the face of incompetence.
Cheadle told lawmakers Trump's Secret Service detail was aware of a suspicious person before the former president spoke at the rally.
If the detail had been past information that there was a threat, the detail would never have brought the former president out onto stage.
One analyst told VOA the early warnings about the shooter raised serious questions. Dr. Scott White is director of the cybersecurity program at the George Washington University.
Most definitely, there was a failure here to neutralize the threat when it was immediately observed. And quite frankly, it would have been legitimate to shoot that young man once he was on the roof. It would have been a legitimate shooting, a legal shooting. So I don't know why there was hesitation.
Congressional Democrats called for changes to gun laws in the United States, saying it was unfortunate that former President Trump is now one of many victims of gun violence. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has still not determined a motive for the actions of Thomas Matthew Crooks, the suspected shooter. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
And now to our top story. Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington this week with a scheduled speech to Congress on Wednesday. The Israeli prime minister is landing in the middle of U.S. political turmoil following President Joe Biden's decision to withdraw from the presidential race, which could add another layer of uncertainty to U.S.-Israel relations at a crucial moment in the war in Gaza. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has this preview.
Israeli strikes in eastern Khan Yunis killed dozens of people Monday. Hundreds more fled after evacuation orders. This is the scene that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu left to travel to another battlefield, this one political, as the U.S. presidential campaign is upended following President Joe Biden's decision not to run for a second term.
And I will tell my friends on both sides of the aisle that regardless who the American people choose as their next president, Israel remains America's indispensable and strong ally in the Middle East.
That is what the Israeli leader says publicly. But analysts say in the potential race for the White House between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump, Netanyahu would prefer a Republican. Jonathan Reynold, head of the Department of Political Studies at Israel's Bar-Ilan University, via Skype.
The Republicans are more supportive of Israel's security agenda, and that would be true whoever was in power in Israel. But the second thing is they're more forgiving of Israel's right-wing government and its policies towards the Palestinians.
Netanyahu has reportedly requested a meeting with former President Trump, who launched significant pro-Israel policies during his term. Trump brokered the Abraham Accords that normalized Israel's diplomatic ties with the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. He moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to contested Jerusalem and recognized Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights. Former U.S. negotiator for the Middle East, Aaron David Miller, via Skype.
With Kamala, he's probably going to get someone who will remain pretty much mainstream when it comes to supporting the U.S.-Israeli relationship, but I think far tougher, certainly rhetorically and Israeli settlement activity, and much more sympathetic to Palestinian suffering and Palestinian rights.
Ultimately, Netanyahu's main goal in Washington is to prepare the groundwork for the next American administration. And with the Israeli Knesset nearing a three-month recess, advancing his own goals in his fragile coalition, said Nimrod Goren, senior fellow for Israeli affairs at the Middle East Institute via Zoom.
There may be a political timing that will enable Netanyahu to make a move once the Knesset is in recess without having that lead to immediate coalition breakdown, because that could not be done until the Knesset comes back to operation.
During that time, Netanyahu could potentially go against far-right factions in his coalition and reach a ceasefire deal with Hamas after nearly 9 months of war. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said last week such a deal is within reach.
I believe we're inside the 10-yard line and driving toward the goal line and getting an agreement that would produce a ceasefire, get the hostages home, and put us on a better track to trying to build lasting peace and stability.
However, most analysts are skeptical the ceasefire deal will extend beyond phase one, a six-week pause in fighting in exchange for some of the hostages held by Hamas. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
In a related story, Vice President Kamala Harris will not be presiding over Netanyahu's address to Congress, as would be customary for a vice president. Aides say this is not because of any disagreement with the prime minister, but rather a scheduling conflict. Harris will be traveling to Indianapolis for a previously arranged event. Meanwhile, in China, rival Palestinian factions, including Hamas and Fatah, have agreed to end their divisions and form an interim national unity government. The negotiations took place in Beijing, as China is asserting itself as a major diplomatic force in the Middle East. The so-called Beijing Declaration was signed at the closing ceremony of a reconciliation dialogue among 14 Palestinian factions. Wang Yi is China's foreign minister.
The core achievement is to make it clear that the Palestinian Liberation Organization is the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. The most prominent highlight has been the agreement on forming an interim national reconciliation government around the post-war governance of Gaza. The strongest call is for the realization of a truly independent Palestinian nation in accordance with the relevant United Nations resolutions.
Musa Abu Marzouk is a senior official with Hamas. He called it a historic moment. The agreement in Beijing marks another diplomatic coup for China and its growing influence in the Middle East after it brokered a breakthrough peace deal between long-standing regional rivals, Saudi Arabia and Iran, last year. The negotiations in Beijing weren't the only ones. In Washington, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu signaled that the ceasefire deal, which would free dozens of hostages from captivity in Gaza, could be taking shape. Netanyahu met with families of hostages and said the conditions to bring the captives back were, quote, ripening, according to a statement from his office. You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A Russian-American journalist is found guilty in a secretive trial in Russia. That story coming up. Now, though, to Kyiv, where there is news of Ukrainian military success in Donetsk and new restrictions on Russian oil. Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
The Ukrainian armed forces reported the hit of a Russian air defense system in Olenivka in the Donetsk region. The Russian air defenses were discovered by a Ukrainian drone. The drone accompanied it to its parking spot in the village of Olenivka, where Russian forces hid it in an industrial building on the outskirts of the village. That location was then shot at by an American HIMARS missile. There is a high probability that the complex was disabled by a direct hit or projectile fragments. In Russia, the spokesman of the Russian president, Dmitry Peskov, declared SF due to the European Union's decision to direct the first tranche of 1.4 billion euros from the proceeds of frozen Russian assets to the purchase of weapons for Ukraine. This is how he commented on the statement of the High Representative of the European Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Joseph Borrell. Peskov emphasized that such actions cannot go unanswered. Russia will work out the possibilities of legal prosecution of those people who are involved in the adoption and implementation of the decision to confiscate Russian assets. Meanwhile, the Russian Lukoil oil company can no longer transport oil across Ukrainian territory to Hungary and Slovakia due to Ukrainian sanctions. Slovakia and Hungary said they had stopped receiving oil from Russia's Lukoil after Ukraine tightened their sanctions against it. The Slovak Ministry of Economy said this step will affect the Bratislava oil refinery Slovnaft factory. Despite a gradual shift to alternative suppliers, two-thirds of the oil it processes is still of Russian origin. On Tuesday, Hungarian Foreign Minister Peter Szijjártó said that Lukoil no longer supplies crude oil through Ukraine. Lukoil has been under sanctions in Ukraine since 2018, but they were limited. In June 2024, the National Security and Defense Council of Ukraine significantly expanded them, adding in particular a ban using pipelines through Ukrainian territory. Ambassador of Ukraine to Great Britain and former Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, Valery Zaluzhny, made a speech at the Royal United Services Institute in London. Among the main theses, Zaluzhny noted that the experience of the Ukrainian fight will be useful to everyone who is looking for a way to peace. And the way to peace can also lie through war. He clarified that the readiness for war should be considered as a huge complex of measures, which covers not only purely military aspects but also all spheres of state activity. Perhaps the most difficult and most important component is the readiness of society, which is based on honest and transparent communication between the government and the people. Zaluzhny noted that unfortunately modern wars are total. They require efforts not only of the army but also of society in general. He noted that the Russian-Ukrainian war proved how technological wars have become. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
In its war against Russia, Ukraine developed sea drones and has used them quite effectively. Would similar sea drones be as effective in other potential naval battles, like the Persian Gulf or the Taiwan Strait, where joint Taiwan-U.S. naval exercises were scheduled to start this week? For more, I spoke with Brian Clark, Senior Fellow and Director at the Center for Defense Concepts and Technology at the Hudson Institute.
So a sea drone is, as the name implies, it's a uncrewed vehicle that's either remotely operated or automatically operates itself, that operates on the water. Most of these have been converted jet skis or converted small boats with essentially a radio remote control like you'd use for a radio controlled airplane. What's sort of innovative about them is that they've incorporated warheads and cameras that allow them to be remotely piloted and driven at a target. And that's what Ukraine has done very successfully thus far in the Black Sea.
Now, I think one thing that's pretty interesting is the creation and the development of these sea drones. They weren't really a thing in war before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. How did they come to be?
It's sort of surprising that we haven't seen them that much before. In past generations, there's been experimental versions of these, but I think it's the advent of high-speed engine technology, like you see with jet skis, that's wide range or internet and modern cheap cameras. All those things kind of came together so that now you can take a small boat, put this remote piloting system on it, put a commercial satellite antenna from Starlink on it, and put a camera on it, and you've got yourself a sea drone.
So what kind of targets have the Ukrainians been able to hit?
Yeah, they've been attacking the Russian Black Sea Fleet, and mostly ships that are anchored or in port, because one limitation of the sea drones is they don't have a lot of range. They can go pretty fast, but they can't go very far. So they've been attacking ships in port at anchor, eventually forcing Russia to move all of them back to Russian territory on the far eastern side of the Black Sea.
So we've seen battlefield success with them in the Black Sea, and specifically in ports at the Black Sea. How well would they do? How effective could they be in other areas, notably the Taiwan Strait, where there's more open water?
Right. So one of the challenges, as I said, is these don't go very far generally. Now, one particular argument for how you could use them in the Taiwan Strait would be if you have an invasion force that's coming at you, these sea drones wouldn't have to go very far to attack that invasion force, because all you have to do is launch them from the beach of Taiwan and your targets are coming at you. And it's just a matter of having the target and the weapon meet each other in the middle. So you could see these sea drones being very effective in the Taiwan Strait, defeating a Chinese invasion, because the Chinese are going to make themselves easier targets because they'll have to drive at the drones to make it to the beach and offload their personnel.
And what do we know about Taiwanese efforts to manufacture these?
So they have not been very robust. You'd think that the Taiwanese would be mounting a more aggressive effort to learn from Ukraine and apply some of those lessons to their own industrial base, but they haven't really put a lot of effort into that.
And as the technology of sea drones improves, how do you see naval warfare changing?
Yeah, I think naval warfare is going to change dramatically, especially in the littoral environment. So areas where ships will be vulnerable to these sea drones. So restricted waters like the Taiwan Strait or the Black Sea or the Baltic Sea, and choke points that will be important, like the Strait of Malacca, could be controlled in a lot of ways by a country that has access and willingness to use these sea drones. Now, open ocean naval warfare, when you get out in the middle of the water and you're hundreds of miles from shore, it'll be harder to use these sea drones effectively. But you will see these sea drones be used for other operations. So they'll be used for surveillance and targeting. And that's where I think you'll see them get used in that open water environment, is mostly as a sensor platform.
Brian Clark is a senior fellow and director for the Center of Defense Concept and Technology at the Hudson Institute. Mr. Clark, thanks for your analysis. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Two devastating landslides in Ethiopia have killed at least 157 people, and that number is likely to rise. Reuters' David Doyle has the story.
The death toll from two landslides in southern Ethiopia has risen sharply to over 150. That's according to the head of the National Disaster Response Agency in Gofa Zone, who said on Tuesday the number could increase further. Marcos Melese said the search is ongoing and that there were bodies yet to be recovered. Officials had reported on Monday that 50 people had died. That's after heavy rain overnight caused a first landslide and then a second buried people who had gathered to help. Women, children, and local police were reported to be among the dead.
Reuters' David Doyle reporting for us today. Elsewhere in Africa, Ugandan security forces have detained protesters in downtown Kampala on Tuesday. That was at a rally against what demonstrators say are rampant corruption and human rights abuses by the country's rulers. A witness saw the detentions being made. A video posted to social media by NTV Uganda also showed a small group of young people being intercepted and detained by police while they were marching. A police spokesperson was not immediately available to say how many people had been detained. Authorities had banned the planned protests, citing intelligence that they said showed criminal-minded gangs might hijack it in order to loot and vandalize. Opposition leaders and rights activists say embezzlement and misuse of government funds are widespread in Uganda. They have long accused President Yoweri Museveni of failing to prosecute corrupt senior officials who are politically loyal or related to him. Museveni has repeatedly denied condoning corruption. He says whenever there is sufficient evidence, culprits, including lawmakers and even ministers, are prosecuted. And finally, Russia convicted Russian-American journalist Alsu Kermasheva and sentenced her to 6.5 years in prison for spreading false information about the military in a secret trial held on Friday. It was the same day Russia sentenced another American journalist to 16 years behind bars. VOA's press freedom editor Jessica Jarit has more.
In a closed-door trial Friday, Alsu Kermasheva received a 6.5-year sentence for spreading what the Kremlin says is false information about the Russian army. The verdict appears linked to a book Kermasheva helped edit about Russians opposed to the war in Ukraine. It is unclear if other charges are still pending against the journalist for VOA's sister network, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. RFERL president Stephen Capus called the trial a, quote, mockery of justice. Media groups are condemning Russia's actions. Carol Lucha covers Eastern Europe for the media freedom group, the International Press Institute.
But this just shows, again, how these trials against these two American journalists, this one a Russian-American journalist, in Russia are obviously completely manipulated by Russian authorities.
Kermasheva's verdict came the same day Russia convicted Evan Gershkovich. The Wall Street Journal reporter was sentenced to 16 years in prison on espionage charges that he denies. The US is demanding both Americans be released. Matthew Miller is the US State Department spokesperson.
We remain focused on the case of Alsu Kermasheva. She's a dedicated journalist who is being targeted by Russian authorities for her uncompromising commitment to speaking the truth and her principled reporting.
The convictions mark a rapid decline in media freedoms in Russia. The country ranks near the bottom of the World Press Freedom Index. And Moscow is detaining at least 22 journalists, more than half of whom are foreign nationals, says the Committee to Protect Journalists. RFERL External Affairs Chief Diane Zeleny says Kermasheva's unjust detention and the risks for its journalists are a daily concern.
It is the new normal. It's sad to say this is sort of the state of the world right now. Journalists are not safe anymore in many places, and the ways to help them are minimal, actually, you know, and they are being targeted by authoritarian governments.
Kermasheva's family in Prague says her detention hits at a personal level. Bibi Buturin is one of Kermasheva's daughters.
It would be one thing if she was only away from me for so long, but to know that she's in an unsafe place and that she's in danger and she's not comfortable, that's something that really makes me sad.
The Russian embassy did not respond to VOA's requests for comment. But in the case of Gershkovich, the Kremlin has indicated it would be open to a prisoner swap. With Liam Scott in Prague and Christina Caseda-Smith in Washington, Jessica Jarit, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.